Welcome to the Hall of Blue Illumination, the podcast dedicated to M.A.R. Barker's legendary world of Tecumel. Here we are in, where are we? We are in a nexus point between the dimensions, nearby the Hall of Blue Illumination. With me today on, what is this, episode 8, are my esteemed colleagues, Victor Raymond.
Hello.
And James Malashevsky.
Greetings.
I understand, Victor, that you attended Con of the North. Would you like to tell us about that?
It was great. We had a good time. It was this past weekend. I don't know if it's President's Day, but it was the weekend of the 17th, 18th, and 19th of 2017 in the Twin Cities. And Brett Slocum has put together for the past several years a Tecumel track for Con of the North. And he's done yeoman labor to put this all together, 60 hours of Tecumel gaming. And it was a lot of fun. There were a lot of people that showed up. There were a lot of newcomers who showed up. There were a lot of old-timers that were there. And we had a good time chatting.
The pictures on the Google Plus Tecumel group looked fun.
Yes, there were some absolutely fantastic games that were being run there. There was two miniatures games that were run, and those were being done by, Bill, and now I'm blanking on his last name, which
Hoyt?
Is terrible. No, it wasn't Bill Hoyt. Bill Hoyt was downstairs. He's one of our regulars on stuff. But for right now, I will merely note that the two miniatures games were really, really good. One was a set-piece battle between Mugloviani and I think Liviani. I could be wrong about that. Might have been Soliani. No, it was Soliani. That's right.
How many? And then you said miniatures?
Oh, yeah.
Miniatures. How many miniatures did they have on the table?
They had probably upwards of 100 miniatures for one of them and a couple of dozen for the other.
Wow, too bad there's no pictures of that. What's that, James?
Which rules did they use?
I'm sorry. I probably should have asked.
I'm just curious.
They were not using any of the Tecumel miniatures.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah. Now, there's been a real sea change in miniatures rules over the past decade or so, and so there are a lot of new rule sets that are, frankly, a little bit easier for people to pick up and use, and covering all sorts of different time periods and settings. So that was actually pretty cool. So
sounds cool.
It was. And then in addition to all of that, there were, many role-playing game sessions being run by lots of different people. John Till was present running his Fate of Tecumel indie game version of the world of Tecumel, which was really cool.
I was going to ask about that. Did you have a chance to sort of train spot that or witness any of the actual play?
Yes, partly because my game was happening at one table over. I was running Empire of the Petal Throne, and the Fate of Tecumel game was actually, interestingly enough, Mesoamericans being transported across space and time to Tecumel, and they actually had a blast. The players were having an interesting time because they kind of had a sense of what it meant to play somebody from Mesoamerica, Mayan or Aztec, I should have asked John, and then to have them translate over from that setting to Tecumel. Apparently, most of them decided to stay.
It's funny you should use the word translate, because that's the key word for the game I'm running for my home group called The Strange, wherein one translates the different fictive environments. So hopefully I'll develop some stuff for the Cypher system and TechML, which is why I was particularly interested in how John had adapted TechML to Fate.
He's doing some absolutely fantastic stuff, and I heartily encourage you to go to his website where he's exploring these things and putting stuff together. So,
well, I keep badgering him about running a Hangouts one-shot. Hopefully that will come to pass.
Well, I think that he may very well have a chance to do a bit more of that as we go into summer, because he really would like to get this out for people to see and play test, and he can get some feedback on it.
Yeah, I understand he's working on some kind of manuscript or another. Do you have any information about that?
John has a license with the Foundation to produce a couple of adventures using his Fate of TechML version of the Fate rules. And I'm looking to see just exactly what he does with that. So, and that will also turn into, I think, a potential for, perhaps a full-blown Fate set of rules.
That would be amazing. Well, I don't know if John listens to this podcast, but if he does, I'm happy to take what he's done and try it out on my home group and report back to him.
Excellent. Well, good to know. And now that I've actually gone back and looked, it's Bill Acheson. Bill, who in fact drove something close to 22 hours from the Baltimore area. And I thought of you, James, when that was mentioned.
Yes.
And he brought a whole bunch of stuff with him. So, yeah, those games were great. So, yeah, so Bill Acheson, John Till, let's see here. Brett Slocum ran his Pedal Hack rules for an adaptation of Expedition to the Barrier Peaks as applied to TechML. That was also interesting. Yes, take Expedition to the Barrier Peaks, play with it a little bit, and turn it into something that you'd find in the Atkalel Heights.
That makes total sense. I've read through the Pedal Hack, and it looks really cool. I hope to cross paths with Brett eventually to get to play.
Krista Donnelly was present, and Krista has she was running a game that she had run a few years ago, which was I should be careful. I didn't actually listen very hard to what she was doing, but it looked like the players she had were having a good time. So, and then I ran a couple of sessions of Empire of the Petal Throne, and that was worthwhile. I had both newcomers and people who had played for a while, and they had a good time. And what was interesting about it was that everybody really got it, that TechML was a setting and that there were different rules that they could use to explore the setting, but that, you know, they should think about what rules they liked and see how they fit. So,
do you have a particular anecdote from any of your sessions that's kind of a highlight that in some way
you
would...
You mentioned one to me the other day, actually, Rick.
Oh, gosh. James, remind me. What did I say?
About the opening of a chest that had poison in it. There was poison gas or something?
Oh, right. Yeah, so... Here was a party of adventurers, and this was my A Night in Old Jakala adventure, which was just simply an opportunity for people to choose one of three different sort of mini-adventures. And in this case, they followed a scholar priestess of Katenku into the underworld to find a relic. And so they're going around in the underworld, and they find this chest. And one of the players, in fact, it was Krista Donnelly playing a Shen, decided that she was tired of waiting around for the humans to figure out how to get into these things. So she took her sword axe and proceeded to bash in the top of the chest, thus releasing the poison gas. And She rolled really badly for her blow to the chest, which is to say it didn't accomplish what she was hoping for, and she missed her saving throw, and she keeled over. And I should say, the Shen she was playing.
Tail up or tail down?
Dead. And one of the other players, who was new to Tecmo, said, "Wow, this really is old school. I've never been in a game session where somebody just died like that." I said, "Yes." And everyone actually got a laugh out of that and said, "Underworlds are dangerous," they said, while beginning to loot the poor fallen corpse of their comrade. You know.
Save or die is a real thing, you know.
Save or die, yeah really. And, you know, to my mind, what I thought was really good about the Tecmo track was precisely that we had a great chance to expose new people to the setting and to let them know that there were things that they could do to find out more. Like the podcast. The podcast got mentioned, and hopefully people will be tuning in and hearing about the things that we have to say. So,
speaking of the podcast itself, don't we have some kind of request out into the world?
Yes. We could definitely use someone to do the liner notes on the album. Wait, that's not very clear. We could use some help here, I think, in producing some notes about what was talked about in the podcast and make sure that we have our web links for things we mention, like Con of the North and books that we talk about and websites that have cool stuff. And if we could find somebody who is an enthusiastic newcomer, that would be wonderful.
Well, if this individual should manifest through the Nexus Point, they could contact us through techmlpodcast.com. There is a contact form there. That would work quite well.
Excellent.
Yes. What have you been up to, James, with Techmel Gaming? I understand you're running a Traveler campaign. Have you had the opportunity to explore Techmel further?
Oh, yes. You know, I mean, in addition to the Friday group that you participated in, last night I played in my Mughalavyani-based campaign, or theoretically Mughalavyani-based campaign, since they are now well to the west of the Plain of Towers and long away from Mughalavya, and they are exploring an underworld beneath a city that is of a strange sort that they didn't even know was out there.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, it is. It's very much off the map, so I'm kind of making it up as I go along.
That's great. I had to let go of my Isle of Vra campaign. I found that I couldn't play in two bands, be a full-time web developer, edit a podcast, have a domestic life, and do all the things at the same time, unfortunately.
Well, that's too bad.
I'm very sorry to see your domestic life go by the wayside, but I'm looking forward to the next game sessions you tell us about.
Well, you know, in the process of putting together the Isle of Vra campaign, I learned a lot about how to do it. For example, there are numerous posts on the Blue Room archives that have to do with Vra, and there's really not a whole lot of information there. But it's enough to extrapolate something fairly interesting.
Oh, yes.
So before I figured out that I didn't have enough time in my life or space in my mind to devote to this, I put together a number of notes and crafted a few new things out of Professor Barker's materials. And that was quite fun. And I hope to revisit it as EPT in the future, or perhaps my Thursday home game for The Strange can maybe use some of the same materials.
Yeah, I think that the interesting thing about doing the work on this for a campaign is that you can then turn around later and apply it to other opportunities for Tecmo Gaming. It all adds. It all adds up. Mind you, this does mean that after a while, you might end up with a head full of what is seemingly trivial information, but you'd be surprised when something turns out to be useful later.
Boy, I have trivial information in many different categories in my life, filling my mind, let me assure you. Computer programming has an enormous number of minute details that need to be beholden in the mind simultaneously. So where would we like to go in this broadcast at this time?
Where did we leave off with Empire of the Petal Throne? Did we want to continue with that? I think so.
Yeah, we could do that. Yeah, I think George had a few questions.
Yes. Let's revisit those.
I think one of the questions he had was for you, Victor, specifically about when you started playing with Professor Barker and what did the rule set look like whilst you were doing it?
I first started playing with Professor Barker in the late 70s. I was a teenager at the time, and I had been invited by various friends who I'd been gaming with already, who were already part of Professor Barker's gaming group. And I lasted for a little while, and yet, you know, being a teenager, still in high school, and I was incapable of maintaining the sort of commitment necessary, unfortunately. And I had to drop out. Truth be told, for that, I always felt myself kind of having missed a bet later on. But I was lucky and got invited back while I was still in college in the mid-80s. I think about 1984, so there was kind of a 4 or 5 year hiatus there. And I started gaming with Professor Barker then and stayed with him all the way until he stopped gaming shortly before his death. I didn't game all of that time. There were some periods of time when minor details like a PhD dissertation had made it difficult for me to be a consistent player. But yes, for pretty much a 25-year period there, I was gaming with him for most of that.
So can you describe to us the physical location where the games took place? What?
Yes. The basement of,
of course,
118 East Elmwood Place, which is no longer owned by the Barkers, and so no need for pilgrimages there now.
There's no plaque or anything? I mean, I'm disappointed.
I'm sorry. There's only so much we could do. I suspect that the nice people that own the place now might even be okay with a plaque going up. Who knows? But no, 118 East Elmwood Place in Minneapolis is an imposing three-story brick edifice from the 19-teens. At the end of a cul-de-sac, right above I-35 freeway.
You can look it up on Google Maps and see a fine picture of it if you like.
Yeah, it's really a great place.
I think that'll be the screenshot for this particular episode.
Yeah, and Professor Barker was very clear. He expected you there. You know, your attendance in class was mandatory. And you were expected to be there by 7 o'clock and no later than 8. And that, I mean, really, when I first started, it was you were to be there by 7. And because that is when gaming would begin. And he took attendance. And later on, that got relaxed a little bit to 8 o'clock. But everyone thought that was a lax deviation from grad school requirements, and so we tried to get there early if we could.
How long was the session? Was it a set time, or did it flex?
Oh, it was flexible. What would end up happening is that when I was there in the 80s, we would all gather around in the basement. We would come into the back door of the Barker residence and enter into the an amazingly wonderful smell of the Barker kitchen. There's all sorts of wonderful Pakistani, Indian, and other foods that Professor Barker was fond of, including anything hot enough to melt through steel. yeah, if he invited you to eat something that was hot, you needed to be aware of what you were doing because you were taking your life in your own hands if you did that. For him, ghost peppers were kind of like a...
appetizer.
An appetizer. No, really, they were. I mean, there was some Pakistani pickle that had not a single word of English on it except for maybe the address of the company. And it was... the stuff was... do you remember the scene in Alien... the original Alien movie where they try cutting the facehugger off of John Hurt's character and it spurts acid and it melts through three decks.
Did that happen to you in your mouth?
Yeah, just about. I'm really not kidding. But no, the food was wonderful. And every now and again, Phil and Umbreen would expect us to taste something. And then we would clamber down the staircase that was small enough that there was no Shen or a Hogia that could ever fit through it down the staircase.
Were you ever served to Maitel?
Well, actually, it's interesting. Not specifically, but yeah, you know, Phil made it clear that he always thought of Chumetel as being a drink was rather like lassi. But not sweetened. It was, or not terribly sweet, I should say. But something that was essentially a flavored yogurt drink that was, in fact, precisely intended to cut through that ghost pepper.
Well, whenever I have it in my imagination, and this usually occurs when I'm reading one of the novels, it's got a lot of fling seed in it.
Ah, yes, fling seed. Oh, yeah. Well, anyway, so you get to the bottom of the stairs, and you turn to the right, and that would be the laundry room and the half bathroom that was downstairs for the use of player characters, because, well...
Players or player characters?
Yes.
Nice.
Yes.
There is a Nexus point in there. I knew it.
There is a Nexus point. And I will merely say that some of us, after having had foods that disturbed our GI tracts, would let us say that there are different pungent odors that would occasionally emanate from the basement. And then you would, after turning right to the bottom of the stairs, there would be a door to the left. You listen at the door and check for traps and then see if you go. And this would lead into the downstairs game room, which was filled almost completely by a ping pong table, which had been adapted for the purpose of being a gaming table. There's no net or anything left.
I've played in one of those in a basement. It's a good thing. Fit a lot of miniatures on there.
Yeah, well, especially...
That's a very good way to actually, if you want to have a big space, that's a terrific kind of table.
Yeah, and it was fitted, actually, with a rim all the way around the edge so that it could hold carpet squares. And those carpet squares were used for the purpose of terrain for miniatures battles. You know, you could clear everything off, and there you go. You're all set, ready to play. And there was a staircase out of that room to the outside that was almost always sealed. It was sort of an exterior exit, but sealed and locked and rarely used because Phil didn't like having his gaming room disturbed. So that was the setting, and we'd all sit around the table. And when Professor Barker was still smoking, he would smoke these really horrendous... just... mind-numbingly awful-smelling Tipperillos.
These made Swishers, of rope?
Almost. I mean, the Swisher Sweets, the little cigarillos.
Those are awful.
They are.
Absolutely awful.
And the Foundation still has his miniatures, which we keep very carefully, in the same cigar boxes that Phil used to store them in.
I have a question about how he would shift the kind of vibration of the room into gaming from small talk. Everybody does this differently. I, for example, will just start describing the opening scene of whatever's happening in the game to kind of get people oriented in the fictive environment rather than talking about day-to-day of their lives. Did he have kind of a trick? Did he do a certain thing? Can you tell us about that?
Early on, and by this I mean in the 80s and into the 90s, early on, he simply would expect that the party would organize itself and remind him of where they were. This is your homework. You must be ready to remind Phil what was going on. Because he, mind you, he remembered. He just wanted to know if you remembered.
Totally. Yeah.
And sometimes with the consultation with his Soliani calendar, which, by the way, is part of that timekeeping thing that's so important. He would in fact make a point of saying, you know, to whoever was either the note taker or leader or, you know, the appropriate person in the party and say, all right, and where were we? And, or words to that effect. And the expectation was you would hop to and let him know.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, partly because there were too many flustered players who would stammer and not be able to answer the question and therefore receive a bad grade and, you know, all of that, he used the device of playing a card game called 987, and we'd play a round of 987 to sort of begin... as a marker of that after this we will now play Tecmo, and that was the thing to do.
That's super clever. I like that.
We didn't always play Tecmo. There were times Jim Danielson would run Traveler, for example. There would be occasionally other games that people would bring and play. If for whatever reason we were taking a break, we would quite often play some game that Phil himself particularly enjoyed. Arkham Horror was one of those games. The original Chaosium version. Talisman. We often played on the roulette wheel that was second edition Talisman, with expansion sets. So in that sense, gaming would start, like I said, between 7 or 8, and then it would go. And when we were all younger and more spry and capable of staying up, games would sometimes go 1, 2, 3, 4 in the morning. There were very occasionally when we were all on a roll, both Tuesday night group and the Thursday night group would occasionally have sessions where we'd all get out of the basement and look around and watch the slightly rosy fingers of dawn stretching across the clouds in the sky and say, well, where are we going to get coffee? Because we didn't sleep last night.
That's amazing.
In fact, actually, a very, very common thing to have happen was to get out of the basement and away from Professor Barker, who I'm sure still had listening devices set up, and we would...
What? Wait. Come on now.
Oh, I'm joking.
Okay. Because, you know, joking. Frank Zappa, Chuck Berry, I mean, there's precedent.
Oh, goodness. No, when Phil was tired, he would simply say, you know, when the session was over, we would break up, and he would expect that we would clean up, and then we would exit, you know, the back door and go out. But we would stand around outside under the streetlights at the turnaround of the cul-de-sac, and we would hash through what had just happened, usually concluding that we were completely screwed, no matter what it was, that, you know, we were going to face some awful calamity, if not in the next session, at some game session after that.
Well, James has certainly inherited that proclivity.
Have I?
Yes, have I. Is it? So what was the age range of the players, you know, vis-a-vis Professor Barker's age? That's question the first. And the second question is, was the player mix pretty stable, or did people kind of float in and out?
Okay, let me start with the age range. Professor Barker, by the time this was going on, let's see now, he was like in his early 50s, about the age I am now, actually, when I rejoined the group. And most of his players were about one full generation younger than him. There were some players who were closer to Professor Barker's age. Let's see here. Dave Arneson wasn't that much younger. Somewhat, but not that much younger. But I would say the age range was really from the 20s to the 30s. And I certainly, by 1984, I was, you know, in my early 20s. I was 21. Okay. So I was one of the younger members of the group. And as far as the makeup of the group, there was sort of a larger circle of Tecumel players who would sometimes come back to play or sometimes would not. Some of the players who had started with Professor Barker in 1974 had gone on to do other things and were either not in the area. This includes people like Lance Curry and others who are still around running Tecumel. They either moved or didn't have time or had something to get in the way of their gaming. Like their personal lives. I just don't understand.
Yeah, what's up with that?
What's up with that?
Why isn't Tecumel just priority number one all the time?
Well, Professor Barker had a very clear sense of that, you know, if you couldn't make it, he wanted to know, like, well in advance. So that, and in fact, actually, enough absences, and I'm sorry, you'd have to drop the course. the result of all of this was that you had a fairly stable set of players that would, the only way that we added people in the Thursday night group was for the most part to simply say we needed to have a consensus of the existing players to add someone. Okay.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And we would, talk about it in terms of who do you think would be good if there was an opening at the game table.
How many players are we talking, and at what point would there be an opening?
Really, how many players? I would say at its height, there could be as many as a dozen players around the table. Mind you, that was crowded. That was tremendously crowded.
Ping pong table.
Usually some people were relegated to not being able to, you know, sit anywhere except, you know, sort of hunched up in a corner. And if that happened, there was a general sense that it had to get back down under 10 at some point. And for the most part, gamers at the table were somewhere between 5 to 8 players at any given time. 5 was kind of low. 8 was considered an appropriate number.
Yeah, sure. A comfortable number.
A comfortable number, yeah. And the rules that Professor Barker used...
Ah, yes, George's original question.
George's original question. the rules that Professor Barker used, for the most part, were an amalgam of Empire of the Petal Throne and the spell corpus from the Player's Handbook of Swords and Glory. At various different times, very occasionally, we would end up deciding that for reasons past sanity that we needed to consult Swords and Glory or later Gardasial as the rules for how things worked. But Professor Barker used Empire of the Petal Throne as the base layer for his games throughout almost all the time that I gamed with him.
So you'd have a character sheet that had your traditional statistics on it, rather than Swords and Glory statistics.
Oh, there were people, I mean, we would generate characters using Swords and Glory, and that was very nice, and, you know, but the expectation was that in terms of rolling to hit, you roll a 20-sider, and then, you know, you roll some additional dice to see how much damage you do.
So really, you could have a character sheet with just about any stats on it that were consistent with the rule set that generated it, and the professor would just adapt the narrative to accommodate?
Yeah, and it should be noted that character sheets were 3x5 cards, and those 3x5 cards were color-coded according to the god that your character worshipped.
So there were 10 colors?
No, 5. It's basically, white was used for Hnala and Hi, and blue was used for Avante and Flamelish.
Gotcha.
You know, orange or, you know, whatever color could be used for, you know, orange or red or the like was used for Karakhan Vimukla. Yeah. And I think green was in there too.
Five and five.
Yeah. Yeah. So
were there two groups running at this time?
Yes. There was the Tuesday night group, which sometime in the mid-80s decided to stop playing, mostly because they had largely achieved the objective, a major objective of the campaign, which was the wizard Iloa, played by Michael Callahan, had discovered how to return Tekemel to human space.
Dang.
Ah, yes, the famous story.
Yes, well...
it's a turning point in the history of Tekemel in many interesting ways, actually, though.
Yes. The Tuesday Night Group was far more experienced both in their tinkering with Tekemel as a setting. They were the ones who would go off and do things with very powerful characters initially to figure out how the setting worked. And they regarded the Thursday night players, as I understand it, as being, well, a bit diffident, if not a bit dim.
A bit dim.
Well, the Thursday nighters tend to regard the Tuesday night players as being, those guys, who knows what they're going to blow up next, you know.
It seems like the actions of each group could affect the other if it was some kind of political shift or, yeah.
It was a single campaign.
I love everything that.
Everything, Tekemel, you know, what went on happened to everybody. So there was one night when we arrived and we walked in the door and Professor Berger said, Tekemel is over.
And we went, what an opening line.
What? And the next thing we know, the story emerges of Iloa and the Tuesday night party figuring out... actually, really, the Tuesday night party witnessing Iloa figuring out how to return Tekemel and the star system to human space. And, yeah. I think this was... I genuinely believe that on some level, Phil... was ready to take a larger break, or more specifically, he wanted there to be some sort of a kind of end to that particular cycle of being.
Yeah, totally makes sense.
And we all looked at him and said, no, we're here to play Tekemel. And he was slowly persuaded that perhaps there was a more sophisticated understanding that ought to be applied. And this led to the notion that Tekemel's existence was part of a larger tree of time that represented all the different possibilities that were inherent to Tekemel from the beginning of time until the end. And I think that Professor Barker then used that as a way to move from a sort of more... There was a phase in Tekemel's play history when people treated it kind of as a, we get to hack and slash and do big things and have our characters become mighty and powerful. And this was a way that he could then say, well, now we're going to move from that to a more cosmic scale of game where the stakes had less to do with what was going on in the Empire and what parties were being thrown in Bae Su, and more to do with what is the ultimate disposition of the gods and their relationships and the College of Wizards at the end of time, and what Phil used to refer to as graduate Tecumel.
Mm-hmm. That's stuff that appears in the later novels, too.
Yeah. So, but yes, for all of this, Phil pretty much used the frame of Empire of the Petal Throne as the base for what was going on. I mean, if you were to ask him later, he would say he didn't really use rules at all. He would just simply use the opposed percentile dice roll. If you roll low and he rolled high, you got what you wanted. If you rolled high and he rolled low, you know, then the non-players got what they wanted, and so on.
Right.
If you both rolled low, interesting things would happen. If you both rolled high, nothing went on. But, you know, I think one of the secrets of the play of Tecumel, one of the dirty little secrets of the play of Tecumel, is that Phil, as the creator of the world, only needed rules to adjudicate things that he himself, as the interpreter of the world, the originator of the world, wasn't ready to handle. And that wasn't really all that much. I mean, the only reason why we used the spell corpus out of Swords and Glory was because it was more accurate to how Phil saw the magic working.
Yeah, it's way more for the players than it is for him.
Yeah, although he insisted bitterly on many occasions that the Swords and Glory rules resulted in players having too many spells that they could use too often.
Interesting. And, yeah, as opposed to, you know, quote, real, unquote, Tecumel.
But I think isn't that what real, unquote, real Tecumel is? It's a lot less magical, though.
That's what I'm saying.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, no, and to which our reply is, as somewhat concerned player characters, it was, but Phil, you wrote the rules. So there. I hope that answers George's question in a bit more detail.
I think that's a very rich answer, and I am certainly happy to have heard some of the details of what happened in the basement long ago.
Oh, there.
I'm sure there's many more. We shall save for a later date.
That's perfectly fine. I do have some other news, however.
Ah, yes, please share.
Yes, from the Foundation, just a couple of things. We're in the process of revising language on the website, having to do with submissions for consideration and basically the relationship between materials that are seeking approval for use with Tecumel or approved for Tecumel and materials that are informal and fan-based. And most of it is just simply to clarify things so that people know what to do. The materials approved for Tecumel policies will remain largely the same. We're just going to include better language to give people guidance on how to distinguish between are they doing something that's just a fan thing or something that is going to require more review and work.
Well, that sounds useful.
Right. And I know that there will be some people who will be concerned about you're changing how things are done. And it's like, well, yeah, but we want to do this so that it makes it easier for fans out there, you know, for people playing Tecumel to be able to add to it in ways that other people can appreciate.
Excellent. Do you have any other news you'd like to share?
Besides that, not at this time. Wait. There is something I should have remembered. And that is, we got done with the scans for Empire of the Petal Throne, the TSR version, and I think we are very close now to being able to get proof copies back from drive-through RPG. It'll still be a couple of weeks yet, but hopefully by sometime in late March, we will be able to let people know that there's a new product available. So,
excellent.
So this will be a print-on-demand version of EPT?
Print-on-demand version of Empire of the Pebble Throne. Right, yes. Excellent.
That's very good.
I have a question about that. Will existing purchasers of the current EPT PDF be able to have access to the new PDF as a result of their pre-existing purchase?
Oh, yes. That'll be one of the other things that we'll do is we'll update the PDF that's there, which was done hastily in the past, and there will be a new one available for people to download and appreciate.
Excellent.
Yeah. I will also say that one of the other things that we're planning on producing after this is a compendium of the articles that appeared in different places, mostly in the Strategic Review and the Dragon, of Professor Barker's writing in that era. So all of those articles that related to different aspects of Techamel from roughly about 1974 through 1980 will be put together into a single book.
That's amazing. What is the status of the Techamel Journal and the Imperial Courier?
As far as the Techamel Journal and Imperial Courier are concerned, we haven't completed a review process yet to figure out just exactly where the copyrights are on that. Because some of the articles were written by Professor Barker, and those we could, we are certainly going to use and make available. But some of the other ones written by other people, we may, in fact, have to acquire new rights to reprint. But as we, as we complete that review, as we get some of these other things packed up and shipped out, we will be able to look into that and see about making some of that material available. I have to say, I kind of doubt right now that we're going to be able to reprint them as facsimiles simply because of that issue. But we're going to do our level best to try to get as much of that material available again, and probably in a similar format to the way that we've been looking forward to producing the supplement of Professor Barker's articles from The Dragon and so forth.
Excellent. James, Victor, do you have any final words or observations for this particular episode?
Well, all I can say is that I'd love to hear from James next time about some of the things that he's been discovering about Techamel, seeing as I've talked so much this time.
No, it's wonderful to hear this. I think people find it very fascinating.
I certainly do.
Yeah. So.
Well, on that note, I shall hop into the hovering gray oval into the plains beyond.
And here I thought Scott was holding onto a ball of immediate eventuation so that James and I, though separated by space and time, could be in the same space to talk with one another.
Well, that maybe would be next lovely. Time. Maybe that would have been better.
Maybe one day.
Don't look me straight in the eye.
Well, I was just going to say, wait a second. If that's the case, which one of us is Baron Ald and which one of us is Prince Dietrich?
Thank you for listening to the Hall of Blue Illumination. You can email us your questions, queries, and other topics at citizen@techmlpodcast.com. You can also find Techmel Podcast on Twitter and Facebook. Until next time, take care and have fun playing in the world of Techmel.